welcome to another edition of Children of Song, the podcast that explores what it must have been like to grow up surrounded by music. For those of you who are taking this journey with us for the first time, we're speaking with artists for whom making music is as natural as breathing. Some of them are the sons and daughters of music stars. Some of them grew up in homes surrounded by family music makers. And some of them began making music when they were so young that they can hardly remember a time when music wasn't in their lives. But all of them are children of song. We'll find out who inspired them, who they might have met on their journey, stopped by, and ultimately, we'll learn what drove them to continue the family legacy and pursue their own musical journeys. I'm Robert K. Orman, and I'm joined by my producer, Brad Newman. Hey, Brad.
Hey, Robert. How are you?
I'm good.
You know, this is going to be exciting this morning. You know, I have two girls, and we've got a young man with us today. And, you know, we kind of complain about kids because we kind of wish they were like, you know, we were when we were kids. But, you know, what's interesting today is we really do have a throwback. And a true classic, so it should be fun.
You may be a classic, but I think we're listening to the future of country music today. Brad's to help me along with this journey, and so is Jamie Pfeffer, who's our engineer. In what we're calling our Nashville sessions, we're visiting today with William Michael Morgan. He truly belongs on our podcast, Children of Song, because he began making music when he literally was a child. William Michael Morgan began playing the guitar when he was in grade school, was on stage by age 13, and within a year was a regular in the honky-tonks of Mississippi and on the stage of the Louisiana Hayride. Last year, he scored his first big hit, the number one ballad, I Met a Girl. And this year, he's releasing the album that Nashville insiders are predicting will make him a star. It has already launched his next hit, Missing. The country radio broadcasters have named him one of the genre's top new faces. Music Row magazine named him a next big thing, and Rolling Stone calls him a country artist you need to know. And Pandora dubbed him an artist to watch. I couldn't agree more. Welcome to the podcast, buddy.
Thank you so much for having us, bud. It's going to be a blast.
I think so, too. You were a kid.
I mean, I still am a kid.
You are still a kid. You're just barely, what, 22,
24. Just turned 24 in May. Yes, sir. So it's still new. I'm washing the new off of it.
But still, you know, you, at a time when most of us are still playing with our toys, you were making music.
Yeah, I was, man. I was still playing with my toys, of course. Mm-hmm. But my toys were guitars and whatnot. You know, I wanted to learn real country music at an early age. I was so engulfed by it. I was so taken by it when I first heard.
Yeah, but five?
About 5 years
That's
old.
That's really
about,
young.
About 5 years old is when I remember hearing, or remembering anyways, the first song that I heard. It was a song by a guy named Marty Robbins, El Paso.
I am a huge Marty Robbins fan. If I could have one voice in country music,
amen,
that would be it.
Amen.
But you know what? El Paso is a hard song. It's got lots and lots and
it's got
lots
a lot of lyrics.
Words.
A lot of lyrics.
And no chorus.
It's a lot of story. Yeah, a lot of story
it's
to it.
Story
I think that's really what drew me to country music was the stories.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the melodies and just the realness of it, you know, with Marty Robbins, mm-hmm. with George Jones and Merle Haggard and Keith Whitley. Some of the people that I was influenced by,
you know
within the first few seconds of the song, that, you know who it is.
That
you know?
Song, El Paso, was the very first Nashville number one pop record of the 1960s.
I did not know that.
It was a number one hit in 1960.
I did not know that.
Wow. And Marty did it.
Wow.
And I wish you'd known him. He was such a cool guy.
That's what everybody said. That's what everybody said a lot about a lot of my influence.
You got to give us a little flavor of El Paso.
Well, I don't know if I
can. I know it's hard to get in and out of because it doesn't have a real ending until he dies.
Out in the West Texas town of El Paso, I fell in love with a Mexican girl. Nighttime would find me in Rose's Cantina. Music would play and Felina would whirl. And there is no chorus, you said, which is weird.
It just goes on and on and on.
It just goes on and on and on and on.
He kills the cowboy who falls in love with wicked Felina.
Exactly.
And then he gets
then he has to run away and still
and he gets shot and dies in Felina's arms.
Right there, the true love story.
It is incredible that a five-year-old is running around the living room singing.
I was listening to that, and of course, the CD that I had, I still remember, I think it was his greatest hits with It had El Paso City right after it on the listing, and so I'd listen to those two.
That was the follow up, yeah.
Constantly, yeah, and of course it had Big Iron and
Don't Worry
and Don't Worry, of course, yeah, and White Sport Coat and whatnot. So yeah,
Don't Worry had the first fuzz tone guitar.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, it sure was.
And later adopted by the Jefferson Airplane, you wouldn't think. Well, most kids know what they have dreams of what they want to be when they grow up. Did you want to be a fireman or a cowboy?
Well, of course, everybody wants to be something else. You know, my parents, my mom is a nurse still today. She's been a nurse, an RN for 31 years.
Mm-hmm. My mom's 31
years. And my dad, he was on the police department. My uncle still, he's a sergeant there in Mississippi. My other uncles, they were all military, Marines, and
this
whatnot.
Is Vicksburg, right?
In Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Yeah, that's
yes,
a river
sir.
Town.
So I was the black sheep. I was the one who kind of strayed away from all that, you know. So that would have probably been my fate, you know. I'm not cut out for none of that, you know. Those are a lot tougher men than I am.
Why do you think that you were attracted to music that was so much older than you?
I think it was the stories, mm-hmm. you know. And of course, at that young age, you don't know. You know, so I was just listening to what my mom and dad listened
to. Did they have that around the house?
They did, mm-hmm. yeah. And, of course, I was born in 93, so... You know,
baby.
Laugh it off. Yeah. When I was born, you know, the current songs on the radio were like Mark Chestnut. We were talking about Mark Chestnut off the air here. You know, which is another one of my big, big influences, one of my heroes.
What a singer.
Yeah. Tracy Lawrence and you know, people like that were on the radio at the time. So I got a lot of honky-tonk knowledge, you know.
I get a lot from the young artists. I get Keith Whitley a lot. I hear a lot of that voice. For some reason, that particular voice and that particular artist.
It's just haunting.
He reaches down through the generations.
He touches your soul, mm-hmm. man, just within those first few lyrics, you know. Mm-hmm.
Do Miami, Miami.
Oh, it's one of my favorite songs. It's one of my favorite songs. Well, everybody talks about the California quakes, and the first time I ever felt the earth shake was in Miami, when Amy touched me. Oh, it shook me. I told her I loved her and I wanted to stay. She said, be sure and I'll call you in L.A. And even in the taxi, I could hear my telephone ring, calling me from Miami, Miami. What took you so long? I thought you'd never call. Miami, 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 love me after all.
He was a
one
good
of my
man.
Favorite.
I wish you'd
Keith
known
Whitley
him.
Song.
I wish you'd known Keith.
You know, I've had a lot of stories with my business managers, Deborah McLeod and, mm-hmm. and Carol Culp. They used to be with Keith, and so I've heard story after story of just that same thing, how great of a guy he was.
He was one of my
genuine and real. And
Mary, you know, and I used to feed him when he before
really?
He got, when we were trying to get him a record deal.
Wow.
He'd come down from Kentucky.
That's when he was with his first wife,
Kathy. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah wow,
he was a sweet man.
Man, I love
how
to hear.
How does a kid with no professional musicians around him start writing songs? Was there an idea in your head that,
well,
I want to learn how to do what
so-and-so
does? You
know, listening to those stories, you know, again, it all goes back to the stories of those songs, you know, and George Jones and you know, Marty Robbins again. You mm-hmm. know, he was the king of the stories, I think. It all just falls back to that and being influenced by that. And, of course, I had a lot of help when I first started coming to town. I was lucky enough to get in some really good writing rooms with some really great writers, you know, by the names of like Roger Springer and Tim Menzies. And,
I love Tim.
And Mike Geiger and you know, Michael White and people like that, really, Wynn Varbal, you know, just to name a few more people. But they really opened their doors up to me when I was just a snot-nosed kid coming mm-hmm. to town going, hey, I like Merle Haggard, you know, and they're going, oh, well.
Are you
Of course you do. Yeah.
Are you self-taught as a guitarist?
I am. I'm sure you could tell.
No, I wouldn't.
I am. Yes, sir. You know how I taught myself?
How did that happen?
To sing and play, actually, was just, I taught myself just listening to those songs, listening to YouTube. If I can be 100% honest with you, a lot of how I learned was looking up Haggard and Jones and Waylon and all that by YouTube, bridging the old with the new, you know. I would just sit there and just listen and listen and listen and eventually think that I could hit those notes, you know, and then I wanted to play. And, of course, my dad played a little bit around the
house.
Oh,
he did?
You know, so I knew, you know, the starting off three or four chords, you know, and if it was in G, boy, I could play it, I'll tell you.
Speaking of your dad, isn't it illegal for, like, a kid to be in the honky-tonks?
Well, Mississippi, that's the great thing about these 50 states. You know, Mississippi's a little different. You know what? It is illegal. But I was accompanied by both my mom and dad. Uh-huh. And, of course, you know, we'd just go in and play, and we'd get on out of there. Now, at times, you know, we'd be there for 4 or 5 hours at a time. You know, we'd get there at, you know, 9 o'clock and play at 10 at night and finish up about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
But they had to go to work, didn't they?
Well, they did. Yeah, they did. You know, they sacrificed a lot. My mom especially, because she would work nights. So, you know, my dad would work mornings. So, I mean, it was rough on him too, having to wake up, you know, after driving, you know, 2 or 3 hours at a time. Because, get this, I wasn't old enough to drive at the time.
Of course not.
I didn't even have my permit at the time. So they sacrificed a lot, man. A lot of money that they didn't have. A lot of time that they didn't have. And
I mean, you're playing now in juke joints and, you know, roadhouses with guys who are twice your age or more.
Oh, for sure.
Was it difficult for them to get them to listen to you and take you know, seriously?
To take me seriously, yeah, it did. But, you know, again, once we got in there and started playing, you know, I think it was kind of clear to them that I was really my heart was in music, you know. It was with the traditional style.
How did you even find some of these players that
a lot of the players you? I found a guitar player by the name of Jamie Cooper down in Mississippi, and I was about 14 years old, and we just started talking to him online.
Craigslist? I mean, is this a Craigslist?
It was like a Craigslist story. I think at the time it was like a MySpace deal, you know. It was like MySpace, you know. I don't think Facebook had even come around at the time. So, we were hitting him up on there. And then he knew a steel player and a keyboard player. And we brought him in. And, you know, one of them knew a drummer and a bass player. And so one of them had the equipment. And so it just, you know, God kind of laid it out for us, and we just started playing all the honky-tonks around Mississippi, and whenever they'd let us sneak into Louisiana, we'd go over there. And
what was your repertoire like back then? What kind of songs did you do?
We played I remember leaving and moving up here, and the last song that we learned to play was Chill Factor by Merle Haggard.
Oh, we have to hear that. We have to hear Chill Factor.
I didn't learn how to play it because there's so many chords. I wish I did, but it's still to this day one of my favorite Haggard songs. That and All in the Movies and
any Haggard song.
Any Haggard song. Yeah. Any Haggard song. But that was one of the, you know, that was a lot of the stuff that we did, you know, George Strait, you know, The Fireman, you know, mm-hmm. We'd play stuff like that, and we just a good old honky tonk band, you know.
Was there a light that went off at some point that said, I've got to go to Nashville? Did you kind of have...
Well, of course there was. You know, everybody, you know, it's always everyone's big dream to go to Nashville. So, of course, I fell right in suit. And so, I wanted to write, and I wanted to play, and I wanted to have an album, and I wanted to get out and play in front of thousands of people, you know, is the dream. And I remember my first time coming to Nashville, I was like 13. It was obviously well before I moved, but I was about 13 or 14 years old, and I remember coming over the bridge and looking over and seeing, like, the AT&T, the Batman building, mm-hmm. and all these huge buildings and everything before the sky rises, before all the new stuff started coming in here lately. And I remember going, man, that's where it all happens. You know, I remember saying, man, this is so cool. You know, I'm going to be in one of those buildings one day. And little did I know that, you know, it all goes down in just a little two bedroom house down on 16th Avenue, you know.
I remember that was my feeling.
That's all it is.
The first time I saw Music Row, I went, that's it?
That's it.
Because you think in your mind.
Oh, you think. It's just huge buildings.
It's like Oz.
Gold streets. And But yeah, I remember that. And I just remember going, wow, I just can't believe this. You know, this is so cool. And, you know, of course.
Did you play it out anywhere when you first came that first time?
No, I was too young still.
You were just...
I was just visiting. I was literally just being a tourist.
What'd you do?
Went to the Country Music Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. Checked that out. Of course, went to Tootsie's and all that. You know, during the day, you could get in. So I would go down there. I think it's like after 5 o'clock. You have to, you know, be over 21. So I'd go down there and was a tourist down there, too. Saw everything.
You know, Dirks Bentley was a regular on Lower Broadway.
Well, I didn't know that. And I got a funny story about Dirks as well. Dirks was my very first concert that I ever went to.
That's what I knew. Yeah.
Dirks was my very first concert I ever went to back in my hometown of Vicksburg, Mississippi. Again, in that same age of, you know, 13, 14 years old. And I, you know, I just remember, I think it was like, what was I thinking was out at the time? I mean, he was still brand new, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course, rocking it hard. And I just remember... to myself at that young age, I just remember going, the girls love him and the guys want to be him. I said, that's what I want to do. The girls are just screaming and shouting and hollering at him. I said, I got to have that.
It sounds like a song.
you mentioned going to the Country Music Hall of Fame a minute ago as a tourist, and now you have an exhibit in it, right?
Oh, yes, sir.
You've got some of your artifacts are in there.
Still so, yeah, my artifacts, which is just still so unreal to me, man. I'm actually paired up with Keith Whitley there, and it's the Country Currents exhibit. It's like a new cat and an older cat, you know. Mm-hmm. It's I'm paired up with Keith Whitley. I think John Party's paired up with Buck Owens. I'm right next to Reba McEntire. I think with Mickey Guyton. I think Mickey Guyton's paired mm-hmm. up with Reba. Dolly's with Kelsey Ballerini, I believe. But yeah, it's just
got of yours in the case?
They've got my first guitar that I brought up here with all of the signatures of all the writers that I would write with me. You know, mm-hmm. one being, you know, Roger Springer and Tim Menzies, the first cast that I wrote with, and of course later on like Dean Dillon and like Wynn Barbel and more of the, you know, more of the top writers there, you know.
And the song that got you in the Country Music Hall of Fame exhibit was I Met a Girl, which
it sure was
a fantastic breakthrough for you.
Is still unbelievable to me, you know, to be able to say it all my live shows and just sitting around in a place like this or just anywhere, you know. It's a blessing. You always dream and you always hope and pray that you get a song on the radio, and then you hope that it breaks the top 40, and then you hope that it breaks, you know, get it to 25, you know, get it to 10, get it to 5, you know, and then it finally happens, and you still can't really fathom it. You know, it's just, and we've gotten so much love out on the road from these fans and these people singing along to us, man. It's just the most amazing feeling in the world. Let's see if we can play a little bit for you here. She don't laugh at everything, but when she does, the planets swing around her. She don't step on sidewalk seams, her teenage boyfriends all still dream about her. She don't need the glitter or the Vegas lights, she could blow a kiss and leave you spinning like a tilt-a world. I met a girl, she made me smile, she made me wait. She crossed the street, she crossed my heart. She fixed her dress, she bit her lip, she lit me up. I met a girl with crazy shoes and baby blues. The way she moves is changing my whole world. I met a girl. Yeah, man. You know,
it's
and
a
that
great song.
I still remember when we heard that song. You know, it was one of those, as cliche as it sounds, you know, just one of those songs that just caught your eye immediately. You know, mm-hmm. and it was Sam Hunt version of it. Sam Hunt had wrote it with Shane McAnally and Trevor Rosen.
Mm-hmm.
Trevor Rosen of Old Dominion. Yes, sir. And, man, when I heard it, of course, it was Sam's version. It was a little more his style, you know, a little slicker. And so, man, I was like, this is so cool.
Because Old Dominion makes records.
And yeah, for sure. And so does Sam.
And so does Sam makes.
And now Shane being a head of a label, you know,
you'd think one of them would have taken it.
They would have wanted to take it, but I'm glad they didn't. I'm not complaining about that.
I'll bet Old Dominion's kicking themselves.
Oh man, kick away.
Back in the beginning, your dad was a big part of this. Well, he booked you, didn't he? Did he not?
He planned everything. Yeah.
Tell me how you set up that first MySpace account and started getting.
Well, he did a lot of that, mm-hmm. As far as setting it up and getting it looking decent.
Mm-hmm. You think he was doing it partly because of a wishing he had done it?
You know, I don't think that.
He did play
a little bit. I think he was just proud of his son, proud of his boy wanting to do something, mm-hmm. you know. And at any point. I'll tell you this, man. I've got the best family in the world. Of course, I'm sure most people will tell you that, but I'll take that to the grave, man. I'll fight anybody over that. You know, I've got the best family in the world, so supportive of me, and you know, I really think that they would have done anything for me.
That's how you wound up on the Louisiana Hayride?
It is.
And that, yes, you tell the people about that show.
Well, the Louisiana Hayride is what really kind of got, you know, like Hank Sr. and Elvis Presley, their starts.
Johnny Horton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, people like that.
Webb Pierce,
you know. And it's still there at the Municipal Auditorium in Shreveport, which is so cool. You see a picture of Elvis, or they've got a big statue of Elvis and a big statue of James Burton out, which James is a phenomenal guitar player.
One of the best.
Yeah, one of the best. Mm-hmm. And it's just the coolest show, man, because everybody just gets back there and it's like stepping back in time.
And you became like a regular, right?
I did, yeah. I played once a month. It was about a 3.5-hour drive for us.
Mm-hmm.
We'd make that and we'd go out there and just spend the day in Shreveport, Louisiana. And
you were young.
I was young, 14 still, yeah.
It's true, you know, I've got kids and you love the way they sound no matter what, but you do have a special quality to your voice and you must have heard that early on. I mean, you must have gotten some validation from people because...
Well, for sure, you know, of course, again, my biggest supporters were mom and dad, you know, but, you know, it really kind of started making sense that we wanted to do this, you know, once other people started saying stuff. You know, because mom and dad, you know, they'll tell you all the time, pat you on the back. But, you know, when you get this person or that girl or that guy saying, oh, man, your son's pretty good, you know, that really kind of opens them up to say, you know what, it may not just be us. He may be pretty good, you know. And I think that, too, kind of pushed them in the direction of saying, man, let's, you know, he wants to do this, let's do it, you know. And at any point, I could have walked up to my parents and said, you know what, I want to be a fireman, or I want to join the Marines, or I want to go dig a ditch for the rest of my life, you know. They would have, I really truly believe, after trying to talk me out of it, I really truly believe they would have supported me in any decision I would have made.
So you moved to Nashville.
Yes, sir.
How old were you?
I was 19.
Yeah.
I had just signed with Warner Brothers.
You had a deal already.
Yes, sir.
How did that happen?
I didn't have no money. Didn't have no money to move, you know. I didn't have nothing, you know.
How'd you get your deal, I mean?
Well, like I said, I was coming back and forth to town writing with writers, and I had already had my management set up at that point. And, you know, I'd had a good team set up at that mm-hmm. point altogether. You know, I'd had one of my producers, Jimmy Ritchie.
Still, 19 and you got a record deal? That's unheard of.
Well, it was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And it is unheard of, and I'm very blessed that they took the chance on me at that young age and still believe in me, you know. You know, the first 2 years of me being signed, I guess 2021, was a lot of writing, a lot of, you know, learning myself. Heck, you know, mm-hmm. going from a kid to a young, you know, a young man, you know. And I'm still learning myself, but...
So you make vinyl, which was your first...
Which we make vinyl.
Your first
we make
record.
Vinyl. We actually had our EP come out first. And that had six songs on it, which included vinyl. And I Met a Girl
was on that.
And Missing wasn't on there. Missing wasn't on there. Our second single was not on there at the time. But then we released Vinyl. I think Vinyl came out like September of 2016, right around the same time that I Met a Girl was going number one on the charts.
Which took a long time to get
it
there.
It took a great amount of time, but you know.
But that's because you were new, you know.
I was new and doing something that, you know, is a little different in today's time.
It was different. That's, I think that's why I loved that song so much. It didn't sound like everybody else.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And that's what I wanted, you know. I wanted to be Vinyl. True to myself. And
Vinyl's a strong song.
Yeah, man. You know, Vinyl is probably my favorite song that we've cut. For the record, you know, and so much that I loved it so much, we named the album that, so I'll play a little bit of it here. If our love was a song, girl, I'd play it all night long, girl. I tell you what, I put it on, girl, I'd put it on vinyl. A little rock, a little Motown, you got that baby pull me close sound. Make the whole room go round and round like vinyl. What we got is a little old fashioned. Baby, you're an instant classic. They don't make them no more like you. So let the needle drop and play it all night. Might have a little static, but it's all right. Ain't nothing gonna stop this groove. Yeah, man, when we cut that again, it was one of those songs that I just fell in love with, you know. It was one of those songs that I couldn't stop listening to, you know. It was, again, one of my favorite songs that we cut.
So over the past year, have you got to meet some of your heroes?
I have. Speaking of Chestnut, too, you know, again, off air and on, he actually cut a new record recently. And he cut one of my songs on
it. He did? You got a Mark Chestnut cut?
I got a Mark Chestnut cut, which to me is just the coolest thing in the world.
What song is it?
It's a song called So You Can't Hurt Me Anymore.
Well, I bet he sings the fire out of it.
Man, he sings the fire out of it. I'm telling you, he does it so great, man.
Can you do it?
I can try, yeah. If I can remember it. This is actually one of the songs that helped me get my deal when
is it?
I first signed over at Warner Brothers. Yes, sir. It's getting hard to look me in the eyes. The sad truth is mirrors never lie. After all the pain you put me through, I always kept on running back to you. There was a time we were the best of friends. You had my back through the thick and thin. Now I realize the bitter truth. All I've got is everything to lose. Well, it's time to go our separate ways. Been going through hell from all the hell we raised. There comes a day to turn the page, and tonight I'm pouring you out on the floor. So you can't hurt me anymore. And he does that song.
I can hear like him doing
that. Like a champion. Nice. Yeah. Really like your hero would, like you would want your hero to do it.
when you meet an established artist, do you ask them for advice? Do you ask them?
I do. You know, I just got off tour with Justin Moore and Lee Bryce, and a lot of their shows I watched.
Yeah, Lee's a good one to learn from.
He's
I think.
A great one to learn from. Justin as well. You know.
Lee really knows how to find a song.
He really knows how to find those songs. Mm-hmm. He really knows how to. Connect with the audience too. Get those songs to connect with the audience. You know, his facial expressions, he's just locking. It feels like he's locking eyes with every single person in there. You know, kind of the Garth deal. You know, and
he's got a physical presence.
He does. You know, he does. He's got that aura about him for sure. And man, watching those guys, I've learned so much on and off stage. You know, I mean, and like you said, little things like picking the songs that. people think are so little but make a career.
Yeah.
You know, picking the songs, I mean, connecting with the audience, what you say right after this song, what you don't say after this song, what you, you know, it's all comes down to a science on stage, you know, and that's what I learned. You know, I learned that you really got to pay attention and get your show together.
Do you like try to connect with a certain person in the audience when you're performing?
For sure. For sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You know, what I like to do is I've got a deal now with Resist All Hats. Mm-hmm. And what I like to do is I like to look out and see, like, the little young kids, like the little girls, you know, like maybe no older than 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, that are singing or just having a good time. And I like to get out. I like to reach down there after I met a girl and give them a hat. You know,
that can get expensive.
It can get a little expensive. But I like to do that, man, because, you know, those little fans like that, that's what makes my heart so happy, you know. I mean, of course, all the fans make my heart pretty dang happy. But, you know, to see those little kids jumping around and having a good time, you know, knowing that they got their whole life ahead of them to listen to music and have a blast, you know. If I can just have one little impact of that, you know.
Do you see yourself in them?
I do a lot, you know.
Because you were a kid yourself.
I do a lot.
Not so long ago.
And going to those shows and singing along. And who knows, maybe one of them wants to be a singer. Maybe one of them wants to be a dancer. Maybe one of them wants to be a songwriter. Or who knows, you know. If I can just have one little how you doing in that.
What do they say to you in the autograph lines?
Man, a lot of it is thanks for playing country music.
Real country music.
Yes, sir. A lot of it is... You know, thanks for being so nice. You know, a lot of people, you know, a lot of the places that we go to are really family. You know, mm-hmm. we've made a lot of family out there, not just friends, not just fans, but family.
Well, that's one thing I like about country music is it is not we're hipper than you.
Yeah.
It is, we don't care if you're 9 or 90. It doesn't
exactly.
matter.
Exactly. You know? We don't care, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, we're doing what we love because of you guys, you know, because of all the people that are out watching the shows and buying tickets and wanting to come sing, you know, a song or two with us.
You know what I like about missing is that I hate being connected all the time.
Yeah, in a world where we are just so hungry for connection and you know, being social without being social, you mm-hmm. know, just sitting at the house.
People staring at their devices all the time.
Staring at their devices all the time.
I hate that.
It feels so good to go missing sometimes, man, and just shut the world off. Just shut your phone off. You know, whether missing means actually going to a beach and relaxing or going hiking in a mountain somewhere or literally just sitting at the house and shutting your phone off for an evening.
Or someplace where they don't even have cell service.
Exactly, exactly, which is a little bit of all of that put together I love.
I find that liberating.
I was just in Alaska. Mm-hmm. Recently, I went missing in Alaska about 2-3 weeks ago, and that was the most fun I think I've had in quite some time. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Again, no cell service, mm-hmm. not a lick of it, and for a good probably 2-3 days, no cell service.
I would have loved it.
I fell in love with it, man. The sun never went down. That was a little weird.
That is
the sun never went down, but you know, it never even really got dusk, honestly. But man, it was beautiful. It was one of the most beautiful experiences I've had in my life, going missing out there.
Take us missing.
In Alaska. I bet my friends are wondering where I am or if I'm still alive. They're worried over nothing. They should know I'm perfectly fine. It's just a mood I get in now and then. When I need to get my head clear, I turn off my phone, get lost, get gone, and flat out disappear. Well, there ain't no telling where I'm bound, the big city or the country or little beach town, but you won't find me. I can't be found. I'm on a mission to be missing. I'll be back someday, I just don't know when. Till then, I'll be a feather floating in the wind. So don't you go missing me, 'cause sometimes missing is my favorite place to be.
Love it. Love it.
Mm. Oh, man. Yeah, you got to go missing from time to time. This whole world will beat you down, man. It'll get you.
I'm Robert K. Orman, and you're listening to Children of Song. And today we're talking to William Michael Morgan. How do your song ideas come to you?
Well, a lot of my song ideas that I write come a lot of it from personal experience and just listening to people and picking out what they say, you know, like, because a lot of people, they try to say stuff being funny and they try to make, quick humor. And I take those and turn those into song ideas, you know, or turn those into titles. A lot of my ideas stem from titles, you know. I'm pretty good with a melody too, but a lot of my ideas I think stem from titles.
That's country music. Ideas. That's country music. Yeah. You have a daughter.
I do.
Has she inspired a song?
She's inspired me to get in the studio and write a whole bunch and do as many songs as I can, because it's not just about me anymore. You know, it's about her. You know, she's about 16 months now. I think just coming up, what's today, the 20 or the 17th? So in about 6 days, I believe she'll be 20. She'll be 23. On the 23rd, she'll be 16 months. So yeah, she's growing up fast, man. I just FaceTimed her last night. She is with my mom, actually. They're fixing to celebrate a birthday down there. My niece's birthday, my little niece's birthday. So she's down there with them.
Well, it's great spending time with you, pal.
Man, thank you so much for having
us here. Good luck with the record. I'm on your team.
Thank you, brother.
Sign me up for the fan club.
Come on. You'll be the first one there.
A lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Hey, thank you guys so much for having us again.
Before we let you go, we want to welcome you to the B-side, the Producer's Notes edition. Here's a chance for us to get everyone up to date and tell one last story. When we recorded this episode last summer, William wanted to share one last song from his new album, Vinyl. He called this next song the most emotional one in the lineup. Here's I Know Who He Is, written by Eric Church and Casey Beathard, a tribute to Eric's grandfather, a man they called Chief, for his lifelong work heading up his local police department.
My album is called Vinyl, and this is probably the most touching song on the album, I think, you know, at least a subject that doesn't really get much light shined on it, you know. It's a song about Alzheimer's, and you know, I think it's just play a little bit of it here. Put away your charm. You can save your heart to heart. I got some memories and a deck of cards that could use some shuffling through. Looks like he's still wide awake. Looks like he still won't take those pills you put there yesterday. Just stubborn as a mule. I don't want to hear he's going downhill. What about thank God he's around still? Looking right through me, he's not at all the way I see it. I don't mind at all remembering for him. He doesn't have to get why I adore him. He don't have to know me. I know who he is.
Mm, that's very cool.
Yeah, man.
You know, they call Alzheimer's the long goodbye.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Man, it's
Ashley
just,
Campbell's a buddy of ours. And,
yeah.
We've been talking about Glenn a lot lately.
That documentary, man, is touching for sure. And then to think that they live that.
Yeah. You know. And she's very strong about it. She wants people to know about the disease, about Alzheimer's.
She's very, very, very vocal about it, for sure.
Next week, Ashley Campbell and Roy Orbison's son stop by for an emotional look at their legendary fathers. Again, we recorded these episodes before Glenn's passing, but it's a real tribute to him and to Roy. two of the best the business has ever seen. Children of Song, the podcast that combines live music with great storytelling. Till next time, I'm Brad Newman. Thanks for listening.